Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What gives a book its value? There is the worth of whatever ideas and information it contains, the cost of the materials required to produce it, and for some, perhaps even sentimental value. Those things explain why most of us are willing to pay to own books. But for rare book dealers and collectors who hunt for particular copies across continents and decades and shell out hundreds or even thousands of dollars to buy them, the point of owning a certain volume has little to do with sitting down to read it. In her new book, writer Alison Hoover Bartlett shines a light on the subculture of rare book lovers and on an odd criminal who appears every bit as passionate about book collecting as the dealers he steals from. The book is called The Man Who Loved Books Too Much, The True Story of a Thief, a Detective, and a World of Literary Obsession. Alison, welcome to Think.
Thank you.
What sort of person becomes a rare book collector?
Well, I think for most book lovers, not just collectors, but book lovers in general, their relationship with books begins at a very young age. I think probably for most young children, one of their favorite times of day is snuggling up with a loved one and having a story read to them. And then a few years later, when they're entering school, they learn to read. It's, I think, one of the biggest milestones of anybody's life. It opens up the world in a new way. And both of these memories are attached to books. And I think that continues to happen throughout our lives. We have our favorite books from high school, college, and so on. For a book collector, what happens is this book love is mixed with a deep appreciation for the book as an aesthetic object. And as they start to accumulate them, what happens is, like with any obsession or great desire, the more they have, the more they want. And I think that's really how it gets going.
Can you talk for a minute about the kinds of things that play into the difference between an older book that is very valuable and one that maybe is just $20 or $30?
Sure. What I found in my research is there are about as many definitions of rare as there are book collectors out there. And sometimes I got a really cheeky answer, something along the lines of, well, rare, a book is rare if it's a book I want really, really badly, but I can't get my hands on, no matter how much money I have. And as silly as that sounds, it's actually very close to the truth. A rare book is one that's very desirable, but not necessarily easy to find or to buy. But I think that three qualities that just about everybody agrees on that determine the rarity and value of a book are scarcity, importance, and condition. And that's as true of a 17th century illuminated manuscript as it is of a 20th century modern first edition.
And amazingly, rare books are actually stolen more than art.
That's right. One of the first facts that I came across that intrigued me was, it was something I read in an Australian newspaper. An Interpol agent was quoted as having said that it's more widespread now than art theft. And I recently learned that the recovery rate for rare books is significantly lower than that of paintings. So it's a big problem.
Well, it's really surprising. You have multiple examples in the book of people actually calling the police to say something has been stolen, and the cops sort of sniff at them and say, well, why are you bothering us?
Yeah, I think, first of all, they're astounded when they hear that a book can be worth so much. You know, if somebody approaches the police and says, oh, you know, this book worth $45,000 was stolen, they scratch their heads and say, wait, a book? What are you talking about? And it's kind of seen as a victimless crime, even when books have been stolen from the library or from rare book dealers, when in fact it's not the case. I mean, especially when we're talking about libraries or rare book dealers whose collections, and collectors actually, whose collections often end up in public institutions at some point, the victim is the public. When these things are taken away by thieves, we no longer have access to them, and that's a great loss.
Part of your interest in this topic started with a single volume that was part of the estate of a friend's brother. And although you're not a collector yourself, you write about this book as almost sort of an enchanted object. Can you talk about why you think it casts such a spell on your imagination?
Sure. I had been visiting my friend Malcolm, and unfortunately his brother had committed suicide several months before. But among his belongings, he had left this ancient book. It was a German botanical book published in 1630 that was used as a medicinal manual, much like a Merck manual would be used today, only because this was 1630 in Germany when the plague was sweeping through. There were also remedies for symptoms of the plague. So with this book, there was a note that said, a friend of mine, that was from Malcolm's brother, that said, a friend of mine checked this out from the library and forgot to return it, and I didn't get around to doing it. Would you please return it to this library anonymously? And the book was very enchanting. It was one of the most beautiful books I'd ever seen. But my first thought was also, it's got to be stolen, because who can check a book like that, this out from the library? It did capture my imagination. I think because of its age in part and its physical beauty, I kept thinking about how this book was around, in the 17th century, and that a mother might be looking for a remedy for her sick child, or there were spots in it that looked like they could be candle wax, and it just seemed to have had a life of its own, and the fact that it was still very much intact, there were no ripped pages, there were stains in it, there were a few pencil marks from researchers, I suppose, careless researchers, but it was, as I said, beautiful, but it had this history and a life of its own, and I think that's often how people fall in love with books, is that there's more than just the content. There's much more than the content.
So tell us a little bit about Ken Sanders. This is a guy who makes a lot of money selling and dealing in books, but cannot shake off the injustice that sometimes these things are stolen.
That's right. He's a man who's very passionate about books, and maybe even more passionate about catching thieves. He's been a book lover his whole life. His father used to joke that he was born clutching a book. He began collecting at a young age. I think he was maybe 13 or 14 when he started collecting books, and then he started selling them in adulthood. And he has very strong opinions about what's right and wrong. And in Sanders' mind, I think there's very little that's more wrong than stealing books. So he will do anything to catch these thieves.
Yeah, he's created a sort of sideline career for himself.
He has. He worked for several years for the Antiquarian Booksellers Association of America, the ABAA. They asked him to take on a volunteer position, which he did, as the security chair. And in that position, what he would do is when colleagues would find that a book was stolen, they would notify Sanders. Sanders would immediately alert the trade. And that's how book thieves often are caught, because they go into one dealer, steal a book, and run across town and try to sell it to another one, get their $5,000 or $10,000 and walk away. So Sanders was in that position, and so when he started noticing certain patterns that Gilkey was creating, well, he did not know it was Gilkey. He didn't know if it was one person or a gang of people or what, but there were more and more thefts happening in the same manner, mostly in the Bay Area, although eventually Gilkey would expand to the whole country and Canada. But he just spent all, he neglected his business some of the time. He just was so determined to catch him that this was his focus.
And Gilkey that you're referring to is this guy, John Gilkey, who was getting away with all these thefts. You were able to track him down in prison.
That's right. When I first saw that German book and wanted to find out what the story was behind it. I knew nothing about the rare book world at that point, but I wanted to find out if the story in the note was true, and if not, who this book belonged to. So I went to the internet and typed something like stolen rare books, and for a writer on the lookout for a good story, this was like opening a treasure chest. Hmm. There was just one story after the other of book theft. Some of them had happened years before, others months earlier, some quite recently. But the one that really intrigued me was a story written by this dealer, Ken Sanders, in Salt Lake City, about the time that he spent tracking down John Gilkey, the thief. So I called Ken Sanders and asked him if he would be willing to share his story with me, and he was. And at the end of that first conversation, I asked him if he knew where John Gilkey was and how I would get a hold of him. And his answer was, oh, this guy did his time at San Quentin, after being caught for book theft, but was released a few months earlier. And he said, you know, I don't think you'll ever find him. If you find him, he's not going to tell you anything about the books because he denied having stolen them in court. So I knew it was a long shot, but I contacted San Quentin. They confirmed, indeed, he had already been released, but I did a little more calling around and found that Gilkey was again imprisoned, this time in Tracy, California, which is about 65 miles east of San Francisco. So I wrote to him in prison and asked if he would share his story, and waited for a few weeks and obsessively checked my mailbox once or twice a day, and eventually got what I was hoping for, which came in a white envelope stamped in red, state prison-generated mail, and inside was a note from Gilkey saying that he would share his story with me. So our first meeting was in prison.
And something that sort of speaks to his personality is that he also, didn't he send you a copy of the forms that you would need to fill out to get access to him in prison?
Yes, he did. He was very eager to talk. Mm-hmm. And that was one of the big surprises in working on this. Not only was he eager to talk, but he was willing to tell just about everything.
So you meet this guy, and he's sitting there in prison, and of course he's in an orange jail uniform, but he's not otherwise a sort of remarkable-looking individual.
No, he's not. He is average-looking, brown hair. He's turning 41 this month. So this was a few years ago when we first met. He was a little younger. But he's a very polite, amiable man who loves talking about books. But on the other hand, he's this ex-con with absolutely no remorse for his crimes. So I found this juxtaposition of the bookish and the criminal to be really intriguing, and it just captured my imagination.
I realize you're a journalist and not a mental health professional, but would you sort of define him as a sociopath?
I would. I was reluctant to go there in the book because I think often these labels are limiting, and I wanted to just show who he was through his actions and his words. But what I learned about him, I would say probably he is a sociopath, but he has not been given any diagnosis.
The ways that you describe him are so interesting. You mentioned the fact that he is well-spoken, but often mispronounces the words that he uses, as if he's seen them in print, but never heard them.
That's right. Like, I think that's often true of people who are very well-read and well-educated, self-educated, but haven't grown up in an environment where they're wide vocabulary has been used.
Mm-hmm. Did you find yourself liking him?
On some level, yeah. I mean, he is a very, like I said, it's this very odd juxtaposition. He was always very prompt. He showed up for the meetings always on time. He told me if he couldn't come to a meeting, and that was a rare rare thing that he would miss one, and he was very pleasant to talk to. I mean, we didn't become friends. We're not. He's not the sort of person I usually hang around with. But you know, he wasn't unpleasant to be around.
Mm-hmm. And he was willing to tell you everything, but you weren't always sure whether he was telling you the whole truth.
That's right. Especially in the beginning, I didn't know how much was true that he was telling me, although a lot of it I knew was true, because by the time I first spoke with him in prison, I had already talked with Sanders at length, Ken Sanders, the dealer in Salt Lake City, and I had spoken with the police shortly after that. I spoke with him. He seemed to confirm just about everything other people told me, and when I asked, you know, we met over a period of a few years, many, many, many times. Sometimes we were meeting every week at a cafe in San Francisco. And when I asked for dates and facts, months later, it would be the same. He was very consistent with his answers, and police records confirm most of what he told me.
Journalist Allison Hoover Bartlett is my guest. We're talking about her new book, The Man Who Loved Books Too Much, The True Story of a Thief, a Detective, and a World of Literary Obsession. You can join us now by calling 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies program, offering a progressive and customized graduate degree with flexible part-time study in Dallas and Plano. You can pursue your passion, and you can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Writer Allison Hoover Bartlett is my guest. Her new book is called The Man Who Loved Books Too Much, The True Story of a Thief, a Detective, and a World of Literary Obsession. You can join us by calling 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org. Allison, what could Gilkey tell you about why he took these books?
You know, he and any other collector I asked about this would hem and haw a little bit. It wasn't that clear to them. I think what evolved over time, though, was this clear picture of somebody who not only loves these books, but also what they might say about him. And I think, again, this is true of most collectors. You know, we all accumulate objects in part because we love them or need them, but also because they say something about us. You know, our choice of cars or music or shoes, we hope will reflect well on us and tell the world what we are interested in and what we value. And this is very true of book collections. And I think it was especially true of Gilkey. He first became enamored of the idea of a book collection when he was a child watching movies set in the Victorian era, he told me, old Sherlock Holmes movies, for example. And he said, right from prison, one of the first things he told me was, I have this fantasy of being a gentleman with a grand library, and I'd have a big desk with a globe on it and wear a smoking jacket. So it's this, you know, we do have, as much as we're a television culture and all, we do have a reverence for books and what they say about the person who owns them, that, you know, this is someone who's cultured and educated and cares about literature. And that was a very, I think, the main draw for Gilkey.
And one of the ways that Ken Sanders was able to figure out that Gilkey was probably a collector as opposed to some kind of dealer was that he would steal, not quite indiscriminately, but there was no pattern to the kinds of books that he was taking.
Right, and also he was stealing books that were sometimes not very valuable. There's an author, John Kendrick Bangs, who wrote some prose and plays, and Gilkey really likes him. Now, he's not, I think his books are probably $100, maybe $200, but Gilkey was collecting those alongside books that are much more valuable, and that's the true sign, one of the true signs of a collector. It's they collect because, again, I keep saying this, but they love the books. It's not all about the money. And of course, they're pleased if their collection value, you know, grows over time. But that's not the primary motivation usually to collect. So the variety of books that he collected and the fact that these books were not showing up anywhere after he had stolen them. They were not showing up on the internet for sale. They were not being brought into dealers for sale. So those were all clues that this is somebody who is keeping the books for his own collection.
Which I guess also made it harder to catch him.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about how he did this. He told you that the first time he ever stole a credit card number was sort of accidental. He found a credit card receipt somewhere and thought, what will happen if I try to use this?
That's right. He said he was in a hotel in, I think, early mid-90s, and found a credit card receipt on the floor and thought, and that was back then they were printing, I guess, the all the numbers on the receipt. And so he thought, well, let's see what I can do with this. And he ordered a watch, a pizza, and a poster from the movie Psycho, which I really liked. And he got them all. Uh-huh. And that stuck with him. He did not forget how easy that was. And so later on when I think it was the next year, he went to his first rare book fair and loved what he saw. And one of the things that he picked up when he was there was he got a couple of books but he used bad checks to buy them, books just worth maybe a couple of hundred each. And he also picked up a catalog from a rare book dealer. And it was this catalog that I think really fueled his drive to start collecting in a serious way. He looked at the books and thought, this is what I want. This is the life I want. These are the books I want. And he ordered his first rare book from that catalog, which was Lolita.
And he told you he thought the content of the book was disgusting.
Yes, he did.
Like he had standards despite being this
exactly, unabashed. Exactly.
So later he gets this job working at Saks Fifth Avenue, which is apparently the ideal place to steal credit card numbers from people with plenty of credit.
I suppose so. I did contact Saks Fifth Avenue several times to get their point of view. I wanted to find out if Gilkey was telling the truth about what he had done there. But they declined every request of mine to talk to me. So, as I said, police records and other people confirmed everything else Gilkey told me. And, in fact, I did speak with one of his colleagues at Saks, who said, oh, yeah, he was a great guy. He worked hard. We all liked him. And so, the credit card numbers he got both off of the receipts, but also when people would ask him, he was working on the floor, they would ask him for a form to fill out, an application for a Saks credit card. So when he got these forms, they had the billing address, they had other credit card numbers, they had all the information that he needed in order to use the credit card. So he would take either the receipts or the credit applications and with him at lunchtime, go to a hotel nearby, somewhere quiet and where nobody would be noticing what he was doing, and copy down the pertinent information, and then he would return the paperwork to Saks after his lunch hour.
And then he was smart, maybe the wrong word, but he had the presence of mind to sort of hang on to these things for a while after his temporary job there ended.
That's right. He did. He didn't want anybody to make the connection between Saks Fifth Avenue and the thefts. But he was working, as you said, in a temporary position through the holidays. But he was hired once or twice more after that. After having served time, even he was back at Saks working.
So the way people would say, well, you got these numbers, but how do you walk into a shop? But he had a whole system set up.
That's right. He was very clever about it. He would also sometimes on his lunch hour. He would take the credit card receipts that he had been harvesting, maybe 5 to 10 a week. He would go to a payphone, call a dealer, say, the typical spiel would be, my name is John Smith or whatever the name on the card was. I would like to buy a wedding present. I need it right away. I want to spend $3,000 to $5,000 or whatever it was. And do you have any 19th century novels, or do you have anything by Charles Dickens? Or he would pick something, and they would talk books a while, and he clearly came across as a book lover and somebody who had some measure of knowledge of rare books, not extensive, but certainly he had done some research. And once they settled on a book, he would say, I'm quite busy today. Can I just pay for it now? Well, who's going to turn that offer down? So he'd give them the number. It would go through. And then he said, because I have several meetings this afternoon, I'm going to send in my assistant or my cousin or some other person to pick up the book. And this way, when he went to go pick up the book, they would not expect him. They thought this was the cousin or the assistant. They did not expect the card to be with him. So they didn't check for the card or identification. So he would just go in, pick up the book, say, I'm here for John Smith to pick up the present. Lovely shop you have here. He made a nice choice and walk out. And it would be weeks until the card owner would know that somebody had charged a book on their card. And at that point, all police had to go on was, or the credit card companies had to go on, was a telephone number that was attached to a payphone. And later he developed an even more elaborate scheme. He would, because he was afraid that he would start to be recognized in these shops, he would have stores ship the books to an address, which would happen to be a hotel. He would not tell them that. He would just say, send it to 200 Main Street. And then he would make a reservation at the hotel, show up a little early and say, I'm not quite ready to check in. Or sometimes he would check in using the same credit card and just say, do I have any packages? And he would get the book.
How was he living during the time that he was doing all this?
Well, he did have part-time jobs, and he lived frugally. He either would stay at his parents' home in Modesto, and take the train into San Francisco. It's, I think, an hour or two away, a couple hours away. Or he would stay at a cheap hotel, you know, motel for the night when he had to work the next day. Occasionally, he would, if he was really short of cash, he would sell a book that he didn't care that much about. But that was rare. In fact, most of the times I think that he did sell books, it was only because he needed to raise money for an attorney when he'd been caught again.
Well, it's really interesting that he sort of takes umbrage at the fact, you know, while not admitting any true guilt on his own part, he was irritated by the fact that dealers would buy things that he figured they ought to know had been stolen.
I'm sorry, what? I don't understand the question.
So he pointed out to you the fact that there are a lot of dealers out there who might turn a blind eye to the fact that a book that they're buying might have been
stolen. Oh, yes, absolutely. Yeah, no, I think that there was a pattern of trying to incriminate his victims, you know, to make them look bad. And so he told me about all sorts of swindling that was going on among rare book dealers. And you know, there may be some, but he greatly exaggerated that as a way, I think, of justifying his crimes.
The interesting thing about the dealers who ended up losing out here is that, on the one hand, they didn't necessarily get a lot of attention from law enforcement when they would report things. And on the other, they were often reticent to admit that this had happened to them.
That's right. And that's one of the big problems in stopping theft, is that there has been a tradition among rare book librarians and rare book dealers of keeping quiet. And this is for a few reasons. With librarians, I think first it's just embarrassing for them to have lost a book, which shouldn't be the case, because sometimes, you know, you can't keep your eye on every rare book at every moment. These thieves are often quite clever and how they go about it. But also, their books have often been donated, and they want those donations to keep coming in. And if they gain a reputation as a library that loses things frequently, they're going to stop getting books. I interviewed a dealer not that long ago, I mean a librarian not that long ago, who told me, and he asked me not to name the library he works for, that somebody approached him once to asking for a particular volume. He looked among the rare book shelves. The book was not there. He looked among the archives. It wasn't there. He looked everywhere and realized that the book had been stolen. But when he went to his boss to explain the situation, she gave him a very serious look and said, "We do not have missing books here, ever." So case was closed. And like I said, this was just very recently. Among dealers, they also have a trust issue. When a collector decides to sell off a couple of volumes or maybe even a whole collection, they will often ask a dealer to handle the sale with a commission. So if they begin to get a reputation that they're not being very careful about holding on to these books and that they've lost books to theft, other collectors will be reluctant to use their services. As one dealer told me, once you've been tainted by theft in this business, you're toast. So they have been pretty quiet about the thefts, and that, of course, is a perfect environment for criminals to operate in. But that said, I think it's starting to change. Just this year, the British Library, after having suffered a theft, decided to go public with it. The man was caught. He was sentenced to 2 years in prison. And the library decided to do a big media splash. And this is something that would never have happened a few years ago. But the reason they did it was they wanted to send word out to the public, and to thieves in particular, that they were not going to put up with this anymore, and they were going to prosecute. So I think there is a trend in the right direction. Also, internationally, there have been several conferences held on security issues and how they can do this job better.
You experienced a little of this phenomenon firsthand when you tried to return the book that had been in your friend's brother's estate.
Yes, one of the first things I did is to call the library from which it apparently had been taken. And the librarian, I even had a call number. There was a call number on its spine, and I gave her that, and I described the book in detail, and she said, "You know, I don't see anything, but let me get back to you in a few days." And a few days later, she emailed me and she said, "We have no record of this book, so I guess it's not from from our library. But I learned after that often if a book has gone missing and stays missing for several years, at some point the librarians give up and throw away the document. So that could have been the case with this book.
You ended up hanging on to it for several years while sort of deciding what should happen to it. What was its ultimate fate?
Yeah, it was hard to give up. I had asked my friend Malcolm if I could borrow it for a few weeks, and a few weeks turned into a few months, and I think I ended up having it most of the time I was researching the book. I gave it back to Malcolm,
mm-hmm.
And he's still trying to figure out what to do with it, but I think he's having a hard time also with the idea of giving it up.
Yeah. Do you still miss having it in your house?
Well, I do. It's if listeners want to look at this book, I have pictures of it on my website, which is www.alisonhooverbartlett.com, or also www.themanwholovedbookstoomuch.com.
And it's beautifully illustrated.
It is beautifully illustrated. One of the really interesting details that I learned about it when I brought it to a couple of dealers to find out when I first came across it, to find out some details, some history behind it. The first man I brought it to was more of a specialist in modern books, and he told me that. He said, I don't know much about this. But because the illustrations in it were painted rather sloppily, he assumed that it wasn't worth very much money and that it may not be the real deal. When I brought it to another dealer who was much more knowledgeable about these older books, he said that the sloppy painting of the book is actually a mark of authenticity. That back then, in 1630, if you wanted one of these books, you could order it with colored illustrations or without. You paid an extra fee to have them colored. And if they had been, he said, if you found a very neatly painted version of this book, it most likely was done in the last century as a way to hike its value.
Alison Hoover Bartlett is my guest. Her new book is called The Man Who Loved Books Too Much, the true story of a thief, a detective, and a world of literary obsession. Join us now by calling 1-800-933-5372 or sending email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies program, offering a progressive and customized graduate degree with flexible part-time study in Dallas and Plano. You can pursue your passion, and you can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is journalist Alison Hoover Bartlett. Her book is called The Man Who Loved Books Too Much, the true story of a thief, a detective, and a world of literary obsession. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372 or by sending email to think@kera.org. That's where we hear from Bill in Dallas, who writes, "Perhaps all book lovers derive a certain amount of satisfaction that their collections represent their particular refinements to others. How will this impulse be satisfied if books leave the physical world and go completely digital?"
Well, you know, it's interesting. When I first began working on this book, I knew nobody with an e-book. And now I know several, many of whom are authors. And what's interesting to me is while they really appreciate the convenience and use their e-books often, they still buy books. Because I think there are certain kinds of books, I guess, people want in a physical form. Textbooks and manuals, diet books and so on might be better to have on an e-book. But, the book as an object still has a powerful hold on people. It's a sensory experience, and the appeal is not all about the content. So I think the book will live, and I think while many books will be on strictly in ebook form, there will still be some printed on paper, hopefully a lot of them.
Are there people who purposely go out and get first editions of books before they've become really notable and important with the hope, like these kids who collect baseball cards now, sort of opposite from the way we did it, with the hope that they will turn out to be valuable?
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. A collector just ordered 50 of my books for this reason. Yes, absolutely. They like to get first editions of books that they think will increase in value over time, and preferably get them signed by the author.
And my understanding is that if they're signed by the author, but simply with the author's name, they're worth more than if they have a personalization. Is that right?
That's usually right. The exception to that is an association copy, it's called, and that's when a book is signed by the author and inscribed to another famous person.
Oh, sure.
But otherwise, just a plain signature, which is called, when a book only has the name, it's called a flat signed book.
What's the kind of, everybody loves those stories of someone finding a book at a garage sale and it's worth thousands of dollars, but for dealers, is there a sort of typical profit margin that they like to maintain?
I don't know that the answer to that. My guess is there isn't a typical one. I think for somebody dealing in modern first editions, it might be very different than somebody dealing in Renaissance era books.
Sure.
So, but I don't know. That would be something to ask a book dealer.
I have to say, by the way, I learned a fabulous new word reading your book, incunabula. Can you tell us what that means?
Oh, it's books that were printed. I think in Latin it means in the cradle or of the cradle, and it's books that were printed book printing's infancy, so around 1501, before 1501.
And so there are people who specifically look for incunabula as opposed to anything else.
Yes, yeah. Yes. There are many areas to collect in. When I went to my first rare book fair, this was in New York. I was just astounded by all the riches. It was like walking into a hybrid of museum and marketplace. You know, imagine going to a museum, but everything has a price tag. I found, the first booth that I went to had really wonderful children's books. There was a first edition Pinocchio in Italian that was going for $80,000. There were also very reasonably priced first editions, The Cat in the Hat, other books. And then across from that booth, there was one that was specializing in elephant folios, which were natural history books with sumptuous illustrations. And these things were huge. They were literally as big as a coffee table and a very thick coffee table. Other places specialized at the other end of the extreme, miniature books, one of which was illustrated by Picasso. There were people who had books on erotica, books on fashion, books on golfing, books on World War II. So, and then books by small presses or books dating from the incunabula time. So there, for every era and time or genre or author, people collect all sorts of things.
How often do you think they actually read the books that they have collected? Are they often too precious to open up and look at?
They are. One of the first surprises that I learned in researching this is that collectors don't usually read the books that they collect, and this is to preserve them. They are big readers, but they just don't read those particular books. In fact, at a book fair in Boston, I passed a booth that specialized in dust jackets, really beautiful, beautifully designed dust jackets. The dealer that was working there jokingly said to somebody else, "Don't judge a book by its content."
And,
it is true that what's on the outside or the physical book is to be preserved.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak with Gene in Bridgeport. Hello, Gene.
Yes, hello. I'm enjoying the discussion.
Oh, good.
I happen to be a book collector, and I'll just relate a story to kind of give you an idea how my feeling as a book collector goes, is that I heard during the Bosnia War, there was a story about this fellow, either he's a book collector or a card. He was a book collector, and he was under siege, and of course he had no water, no heat, anything. And what he did was to heat some meager food for him and his wife, maybe, he would have to choose a book from his collection one a day to burn to heat the food. And I thought, when I heard that, I would never do that.
You'd rather die first.
I would have went out and stole some wood, not a book.
Gene, very briefly, what kinds of books do you collect?
Well, thanks for asking. I started when I was 30, and I'm a materials and process engineer. I was in the aerospace business. Went to a few auctions, and at those auctions, I bought a number of boxes of books for 50 cents each, a box. And I discovered that the illustrations in books, older books, before had to be either engravings, lithographs, etchings, and so forth. And then I woodcuts. And I thought, man, these processes and techniques these people did to put these pictures in magazines. I mean, they even had periodicals. They had all kinds of artists.
You know, Gene, I'm so sorry. I think that your signal's breaking up, but it was a great story, and thank you so much for sharing. It does come up in the book, Allison, that there are people who specifically want only the illustrations within these books.
Yes, and I think there was a man who was stealing maps, and Smiley was his name, a few years ago, that was caught cutting maps out of books and stealing other very precious, rare items from college, university libraries, and other rare book libraries around the country. Yeah, people will sometimes go in and cut out the illustrations or cut out the maps. It's very sad because, of course, even if those items are recovered, the books have been mutilated permanently, and sometimes they're one of a kind, and it's a great loss to the library.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go next to Gus in Dallas. Hey, Gus.
Hello. I was wondering if there is any place, like online, to find out the prices of books, the value of different books?
Yes, there are. Abe Books, ABEBOOKS, lists a number of, a lot of rare book dealers list their books there also. I would also just recommend, by the way, because online you will find dealers who think they know a first edition from a 10th edition when they don't really. In fact, when I was first working on this, I decided to get a couple of modern first editions. They weren't terribly valuable, maybe $40 each. And I had been warned to only buy from ABAA dealers. And I was in a hurry, though, because the author was coming through San Francisco the next week, and I needed to get these books right away. So I ordered from a dealer who was very nice, but ended up sending me a book that wasn't a first edition. And afterwards, she apologized, and I got some of my money back. But it's really important to do the research on the dealer who you're buying from. And I would advise people to buy from ABAA dealers. So look online, do a little bit of research, but ultimately talk with somebody you know has a good reputation. And online, I've seen people who have a good reputation in the eBay sense. They have 5 stars and nothing but good reports, but in fact, they turn out to be swindlers. So I'd be careful online.
Let's go next to James in Fort Worth. Hey, James.
Oh, good afternoon. Very much enjoying the show. I'm actually involved in difficulties in the art world, not the book world, but I'm curious if the author, during her investigation, has developed a feel for how solid, in general, the antique book market is. Is it something that one needs to be very wary of, or that one can be generally expected to be treated well and have good business dealings? Thank you.
Thanks for your call.
Well, I think, again, I would say work with ABAA dealers. They have to go through a lot of they have to have been in business for a long time, get recommendations from other ABAA dealers, and they're scrutinized very closely before they're allowed to become members of the organization. So I think there is a lot of fraud and forgery. Actually, there's already been forgery with my own book. Extraordinarily enough, about 4 days ago, I found that somebody online was listing signed first edition copies of my book for $100. And I have not yet signed a single book.
I don't mean to laugh because you're the one who's losing out here, but I suppose that's a measure of the success of the book, is it not?
Well, I hope so, but Ken Sanders was the one who first spotted it and asked me if I had signed any books yet, and I had not. And he contacted the dealer and questioned him enough that the dealer came to his senses and took the posting down. But I can't say it enough. Go with ABAA dealers. It really makes a difference. There are people out there who are forging books, who are telling you it's a first edition when it's not, who are rebinding books sometimes with a first edition title page when it's not, and you do have to be careful.
The last thing I want to ask you about in the short amount of time we have left, Allison, is, you know, you have in the book a couple of different stories of these miraculous finds where people buy something at an antiques mall or a junk shop for a few dollars and they turn around and it's worth hundreds of thousands. I can't help but think about the person who unwittingly let that book go.
I know.
And maybe they never find out, but you'd have to think you could not have been a bigger idiot than to sell that book. Did you give those people any thought as you were writing all these stories?
Oh, yes, I did. Although that one story that you just mentioned, it was a New Hampshire man who collected books on local history, I believe, and was looking through this antiques barn and found a box of books at the bottom of which was a pamphlet called Tamerlane and Other Poems. And there was no author listed. It just said, "By a Bostonian." Well, he knew enough about rare books to know that this could, if it was the real deal, was worth a lot of money. It turned out to have been the first book published by Edgar Allan Poe when he was just 14 years old. And he bought it for $15, went to Sotheby's the next day, and it ultimately sold at auction for $198,000. So there are those stories. Who put it in that box? I just kind of hope that in cases like that, somebody who bought that pamphlet at the time that it was published, put it away with all their books, and it just kept getting passed down in a box or a bookshelf so that nobody really knew what they had lost, because that would be an awful thing to learn, wouldn't it?
It's just better not to know, absolutely.
Yeah.
The new book by writer Allison Hoover Bartlett is called The Man Who Loved Books Too Much, The True Story of a Thief, a Detective, and a World of Literary Obsession. Allison, it's been a real pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thank you for listening and have a great day.
Think is produced by Jeff Whittington and engineered by Jeannie Mascoro. Learn about upcoming programs, subscribe to our free daily podcast, and order CD copies of your favorite Think shows on the radio page of KERA.org. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@KERA.org.